Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. This is a moment when protecting the country we love, I believe, increasingly requires us to understand the importance of, well, protecting, yes, I would argue, but certainly not harming another country that we love, and that would be the Jewish state of Israel. It is unfortunately not the policy of the United States government to avoid harming our friend and key Middle East ally. To the contrary, the Biden administration increasingly is manifesting not only a willingness to cause such harm, but possibly create conditions in which the very existence of Israel itself is imperiled. And the prism through which I would like very much to take stock on all of this is, how are the Palestinians, Hamas most obviously, but others that are said to be partners for peace, the Palestinian Authority specifically, what are they saying about all of this? And is it the case that they are being emboldened to even more horrific acts of violence against Jews and the nation of Israel as well? And who better to help us make sense of all of this, to understand, you know, the situation on the ground at the moment and what Palestinians are saying, at least, writing and putting on television, that is a clue to what they are actually thinking as well, than our friend and very esteemed comrade in arms. That would be Itamar Marcus, the founder and president of a terrific organization in Israel, Palestinian Media Watch. It is an indispensable resource, I believe, for understanding, well, how the enemy, yes, the enemy of Israel, to be sure, but I believe also our enemies, are perceiving what the Biden administration is doing. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes, Itamar, to join us again. It's great to see you, and even better to have you and your analysis available to our audience.
Thank you for inviting me, Frank. It's always great to be with you.
Thank you. Let me start by just asking you, I guess, to kind of level set. We've watched and been chronicling on this program now with, you know, folks like you in Israel, as well as our own team here, what Biden is doing. So I'm going to sort of just stipulate for the purposes of this discussion that our audience is conversant in the kinds of things that Biden has been up to, including now most recently cutting off arms to Israel, a resupply that's desperately needed, but also, you know, trying to bring down the government of Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, greenlighting prosecution of both the prime minister and some of his cabinet members by the International Criminal Court. I would add to the list putting a port in Gaza that will almost certainly be used for the resupply and propping up of Hamas. So just with that as kind of the backdrop, what is Hamas saying? What are Palestinians elsewhere, both in Gaza and beyond, telling each other about how this looks to them, and what clues might that give us as to where they're going to go from here?
One of the most significant things is that Hamas keeps telling its people and announcing that it's been victorious in its war against Israel. Even though a good part of the Gaza Strip has been destroyed, even though probably 80% of the army structure of Hamas has been destroyed, about half of their terrorists have been destroyed, have been killed, yet they think they've won. And they think they've won because they see the fact that the United States is putting pressure on Israel for all to have a ceasefire. A ceasefire now would be total victory for Hamas, and the United States is putting pressure on Israel. This is a genocidal terror organization that already did the worst massacre of Israelis, of Jews, since World War II, since the Holocaust, and they have to be destroyed. And the
now,
United States...
let me just ask for a clarification. When you say a ceasefire would be disastrous, are you talking about a permanent ceasefire? Are you talking about a ceasefire of any duration at all? What's your specific concern, if you would?
Well, they're both terrible. The short-term ceasefire, that they're talking about now for a couple of months, in which during which time we would only have released 20 of the 130 hostages, would be a disaster. They also, Hamas is also asking for 100 terrorists, terrorist murderers, and they can choose which terrorist murderers. In other words, these are conditions that will make it, first of all, it'll be a death sentence for the rest of the hostages. It will make going back to the war to fight against Hamas even harder because they will have all this time to rebuild their armaments, to plan their strategy again, to smuggle in more weapons from various different ways. So it is a disaster. The United States should be rejecting this out of hand. The United States should be behind Israel. Instead, they're giving a message to Hamas, you sit there and keep rejecting every offer that Israel gives, and we'll keep insisting that Israel give more compromising offers. And this is the tragedy, that Israel keeps offering ridiculous things that will really be disastrous for the country. And the United States is really the force that is driving this. And this is the great tragedy. Hamas is aware of this. They realize that they are, in addition to not being destroyed by Israel, they realize that they've built a wedge between the United States and Israel, which is a great celebration for them. That's why they think they've won the war.
Right. Of course, this is probably especially true of Palestinians in Gaza at the moment, but there are a lot of them on what is often described as the West Bank, historically and more accurately known as Judea and Samaria, the heartland of the original Israel. Is there any difference being exhibited in what's being said, what's being published by, well, you know, civilians in Gaza, but most especially the Palestinian Authority that nominally rules there?
Well, the Palestinian Authority has a major dilemma. On the one hand, they are thrilled when Israelis get killed. On the other hand, they were also very happy to see Hamas defeated by Israel. They're also happy to have civilian casualties in Gaza. The Palestinian Authority has always promoted their own people to seek martyrdom, and then they complain to the international community. So what's happening for the Palestinian Authority, it's a win-win situation for them. They're seeing Hamas getting beaten soundly, and Hamas is, of course, the political threat to them, and that they're thrilled about, even though they won't say it publicly. They're seeing many civilians killed, which for them enables them to run to the UN and to run to the international court and say Israel is killing civilians. So for this, the Palestinian Authority is thrilled. And then we have outrageous things like the United Nations voting to upgrade the status of the PA. This war, you know, as much as the Palestinian Authority pretends that it's crying and it's suffering and it's all upset about the casualties, they are busy celebrating every second of the day, because this has been for them a windfall. This has put them into the spotlight. It has had so many countries talking about a Palestinian state now, and Hamas is being destroyed in Gaza. So the Palestinian Authority is thrilled.
Okay. And to the extent that the Palestinian Authority is saying one thing in public, as opposed to their private sentiments, which you've just characterized, I think, very well, is there any material difference between what the Palestinian Authority is saying about Israel and its willingness to live side by side in peace with Israel, as opposed to driving the Jews from the river to the sea, as is often said now on American college campuses, among other places, and is clearly associated with Hamas?
The Palestinian Authority has been saying from the river to the sea.
I have to take a break. We'll be right back with more with Itamar Marcus. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In Atlanta today, we'll be holding the first of several urgent briefings in key swing states about what should be one of this year's most important voting issues, the strategic arson creating a global conflagration properly dubbed not World War III, but World War Z. After all, it was at a meeting 2 years ago between Chinese dictator Xi Jinping and Russia's Vladimir Putin that they announced a no-limits partnership. Its first manifestation was Putin's Chinese-enabled invasion of Ukraine. Successive meetings in Beijing between Xi and Iranian and Palestinian leaders preceded their invasion of Israel and ensuing regional crises. And Venezuela's tyrant Nicolas Maduro returned from a visit to Xi in China, pledging to attack neighboring Guyana. The question occurs, will today's Beijing summit with Putin result in Xi's next act of arson? Perhaps against Taiwan or even us? This is Frank Affney.
We're back. We're visiting with Itamar Marcus, the founder and president of Palestinian Media Watch. I commend strongly to you its reporting on what Palestinians are saying, writing, thinking, as well as their analysis of the implications of it all. Itamar, I ran out of time to give you a chance to answer the question that I put to you, which is basically that, is there a material difference between the attitude of the Palestinian Authority towards Israel and that of Hamas?
So the phrase, the slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," was actually coined by the Palestinian Authority and the PLO a long, long time ago, long before Hamas started using it, and they continue to use it. What's also significant in terms of...
And just to be clear, is there any doubt in your mind that the plain meaning of that expression is genocide of the Jews?
The plain meaning is destruction of Israel and expulsion of the Jews. They also talk about the genocide of Jews, but that particular expression is more about expelling all of the Jews. The religious leaders will often talk about the genocide of the Jews as being necessary because they're such an evil force in the world. Both Palestinian Authority and Hamas. But the key thing here is this. Long before October 7th, the Palestinian Authority has been telling its own people that their goal is, in stages, to wear away at Israel, to get more and more land, and ultimately Israel will not be able to survive. They constantly compare Israel to the Crusaders. They talk about the Crusaders being here 200 and something on odd years in the area, and eventually they were expelled by Islamic forces. They say, so too, we just have to be patient. Time is on our side. We will destroy this state and we will create Palestine from the river to the sea. This has been their message before October 7th. Now, since October 7th, they have so much support around the world. They have so much support around the world saying that identical message. They have so many countries from the West who theoretically should be allies of Israel and anti-terror, who are talking about creating an independent Palestinian state. You've got the United Nations that overwhelmingly... Now, the Palestinian Authority will never become more moderate with this kind of backing. With so many people in the world defending them and cheering, and academia around the world talking about Israel being a colonial implant with no right to exist, the Palestinian Authority will never become more moderate. I think the days of the moderate Palestinian Authority, that was the very, very early part of the Palestinian Authority. They've been coming more extreme ever since, and now they will be, from now on, the most extreme that they ever have been, as they continue to tell the West that they want to live beside Israel, but to their own people, they are busy planning for that day when they could really get Israel weak enough that they could do what happened in October 7th in Gaza. Their goal is to do that throughout all of Israel.
Yeah. Itamar, there's so many different aspects of this problem that I want to touch on with you, but very quickly, you have, in addition to large numbers of Palestinians living outside of the control of Hamas, notably, as I said, in Judea and Samaria. But there are also substantial numbers that are actually citizens of Israel, Arabs, Muslims, I think, generally. Some Christians, yes, but mostly Muslims. What are you seeing? Are you tracking what they're saying as well? And are you seeing shifts in both their public comments, but also their behavior?
So right after October 7th, the Israeli Arab population was so horrified by the massacres, the rapes, the decapitations, the burning of people alive, that they, having been influenced by what the Western values, the good values in Israel, they were horrified by this and they rejected it. And they distanced themselves from Hamas very strongly. But what's happening is that in the interim, because Israel had to fight back, and because there have been a certain amount of civilian casualties in the Gaza Strip, they are now becoming to be more vocal. Certainly someone like Ahmad Tibi, who's a member of the Knesset, who's an Israeli Arab, he has been very, very vocally anti-Israel, condemning Israel for the civilian casualties. So I think we're seeing a shift in their allegiance to Israel as a victim of October 7th. Now they're shifting their allegiance to the Palestinians as victims of Israel's response. But I just have to add one thing to this, because I know the Western press is constantly talking about all those terrible civilian casualties. It's been documented in this war, even using the exaggerated numbers by Hamas of about 33,000 dead, Israel has said that 14,000 to 16,000 terrorists have been killed, which means it's approximately a figure of one terrorist to one civilian has been killed. In the United States wars, the UN has documented, I think it was been Afghanistan and Iraq. One of them, the figure was one combatant for three civilians. The other one was one combatant for five civilians. So that, you know, Israel is doing better than anyone. Israel is doing the best. And unfortunately, we are losing soldiers because of what we're doing. We're losing our boys, our relatives. That's the outrage, that we're not only doing the best of anyone, we're also being blamed as if we're the worst. And it's just an outrage.
It is indeed. Itamar, this may be our final point. In addition to the various Palestinian communities that you monitor, a story that is not getting the attention it deserves in this country is the increasing violence being meted out by Hezbollah in Lebanon and into northern Israel, the Golan Heights, the Galilee, and so on. Could you shed any light on whether this increasing malevolent activity is a product of the increasing confidence of Hezbollah that it too will be able to attack Israel without triggering a very harsh response from the United States? And for that matter, the United States will be undermining the response that Israel might be able to give.
Yes, the United States' pressure. Now, first of all, just the facts. Hezbollah started firing on Israel as soon as the war started in October, right after October 7th. Israel became so bad that Israel had to evacuate 80,000 civilians who live in the northern part of Israel. They've been away from their homes now, refugees in their own country now for over 7 months. And there is not a day that there is not continued bombing of the north. We're losing soldiers every week, but losing some of the civilians who didn't evacuate. We're losing all the time. And this is going on. This is a war that no one is even noticing. And then Israel's fighting back. Israel has promised the people of the north that we are going to eliminate the threat from Hezbollah. Now, we can't do that without those heavy weapons that the United States is withholding, without the artillery that the United States is withholding. Why would the United States want to embolden Hezbollah, which is another proxy of Iran? These are the threats to all humanity. Where is the leadership that we would expect from the United States now? Go after all Iran and their proxies, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen. It's outrageous, and they are emboldened, and the entire Israel will pay, and the entire world eventually will pay.
Amen. Well, let me just say, you've asked the right question. Where is the United States doing this? It's really not the United States. It's the government of the United States under Joe Biden. I don't believe for a moment that it enjoys the support of the American people. It's being done despite that fact, unfortunately, but it's a basis for, I believe, corrective action. And one of the things that we're very determined to try to help do at the Center for Security Policy is awaken our countrymen and women to the actual state of what's being done in their name to Israel, and with the knock-on effects that you've just described, Itamar. And I encourage everyone in this audience to go to centerforsecuritypolicy.org. There's a prominently on that homepage, box for the Middle East program run by our friend David Wormser. Check it out. Check out specifically the things that we encourage you to do to help Israel at this moment of great need. Itamar Marcus, thank you so much for your excellent insights and for all the work you do. Come back to us with updates very soon, if you would, sir. In the meantime,
you're very welcome.
Stay well. Godspeed. We'll be right back, folks. Please stay tuned. Well, we're in the mobile studio in Atlanta, and we're visiting, I'm very pleased to say, with one of my favorite guests. His name is Brian O'Shea. He is a man with a background in military intelligence, in the in private intelligence business these days. He also is a contributor to a wonderful outlet headed up by his magnificent wife, Naomi Wolf, entitled The Daily Clout. You can follow him and her at dailyclout.io. Brian, it's great to have you back. Thank you for joining us on rather short notice. It's always a delight to be able to catch up with you.
Likewise, Frank, and thanks for having me.
Listen, I've been following you closely of late on a matter of mutual concern, and I'd like to talk with you for this segment about your current thoughts on what is happening and what needs to happen with respect to this stealthy bid by the Biden administration and a number of other unsavory characters, including the Chinese Communist Party, the World Economic Forum, the European Union, the United Nations, Bill Gates, and Big Pharma, to essentially seize our sovereignty and give it to a guy by the name of Tedros Ghebreyesus. Remind us who he is, what it means that he might be in charge of our sovereignty, and the state of play with respect to this effort, if you would.
Sure. So as I'm sure a lot of your viewers know, is he is the director of the WHO. His primary role is to be a sock puppet for the Chinese Communist Party. So by ceding power to Tedros, we might as well just be giving it to Xi Jinping.
And the power in question is what?
Oh, the sky's the limit, Frank. The way this pandemic treaty or accord or whatever they're calling it today is written, the keys and definitions, and it always is in this type of legislation or laws, Tedros can basically decide when the next pandemic is, but also how many there are and also what they are. So think of anything on the planet that falls into the categories of animals, humans, plants, and the earth. That gives you climate change, violence, depression, you name, the sky's the limit. So if he decides, Tedros decides that, hey, depression is a global health emergency, then they can lock everyone down until everyone's happy. The beatings will continue, as they say.
Until morale improves, famously, right? So this sounds unbelievable, Brian. Not clear why anybody would want to do this. What are the motivations for it? And remind us, this is all the more bizarre in light of what Biden and company did with Tedros Ghebreyesus during the recent pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, I think the main driving motivation for this is to essentially take over or eradicate the sovereignty of all the nations of the world just in time for the China rejuvenation of 2049, which means China will be the global hegemon by that time. That's also the 100-year anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party, the official birthday of it. So what I ask people to do, and I was asking just recently on a space, is take the word health out of the thought process and then reverse engineer. If you wanted to take over the world, how would you do it? And then you backwards plan. So one of the ways you have to do that is you have to take out the United States of America. We're the most powerful nation, the most powerful free nation. That has to go. And so what is the motivation behind all of it? The more I read through the One Health ideology, which sits underneath the pandemic treaty, as well as the players involved, the organizations involved at the national level and the international level, and just the language, just hitting a control F on any of these documents and looking for the word land. It appears so many times, more than health even in some cases. So what's the goal? The goal is to conquer us without firing a shot.
And again, the reason that these bad guys might have for wanting to do something like this is obvious, you know, getting control of the United States, diminishing its power, essentially bringing it down as a constitutional republic, at least. But why would an American government want to do that? Why is Joe Biden's administration seemingly, well, not only going along with this, but I understand, Brian, is actually a leading force behind it.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And if you look at that Global Health Security Act that the United States put out in April of 2024, it's terrifying. Why would they go along with it? You know, that's a really difficult question because I don't know the people personally. I know some of them personally involved. But from my experience, having traversed many different social classes in my work, in my relationships, their allegiance is not to the United States, nor has it ever been. These are the people in our government, these are the people that are raised in a thinly veiled Marxist education system. These are the people that were singing about the one world, everyone's together, it's a small world. All of that propaganda is in their, it's in their DNA almost. And so these are also the people that you just want to sometimes strangle because you'll be sitting there having a drink and they'll say something stupid like, oh, I'm a citizen of the world. I mean, this is the mentality. So they don't see it as America should be sovereign.
Sense of the word, obviously, you're not actually talking about physical violence or anything. But Brian, I guess
I'm not.
The ideology is operating here, at least in some quarters of the administration, and that would be Marxism, I would argue. You talked about pedigree of Tedros as a sock puppet of China. There's a lot of concern, and I think you share it, about the extent to which, well, Joe Biden, for one, and a lot of people in senior ranks of his administration, to say nothing of, you know, elsewhere in the bureaucracy, have, you know, kind of embraced this idea, at the very least, of American decline and the ascendancy of China, if not actually admiring and wanting to help along the Chinese ambition to be the world's dominant power. Is that a concern as well?
Yeah, it's a concern. It's a concern that they've been convinced that the devil doesn't exist, essentially, the devil being the Chinese Communist Party. So why do I say that? Is because having worked and done business with China for clients, they're the nicest people to work with. You're like, you meet them, you're like, oh my God, they're really nice and very polite. What happens also is the people making these decisions are getting a lot of money, and they got a lot of money prior to, like, Blinken's firm that he was with, anyone involved in the Humpty Dumpty group. All of these organizations make massive amounts of money. And again, I'm not in their heads, but I know what Western hubris is. We see it every day. I almost believe that some of these people think, hey, we'll make a ton of money on this, and when we have to put the leash on China, we will, not realizing that they won't be able to, and they're not able to now.
Yeah, exactly right. So, Brian, to just come to the key issue of the moment, which is in something like 12 days, the Biden administration, with all of its friends in the World Health Organization and elsewhere, are set on trying to get not one but two treaties approved that would affect this kind of, well, to use Barack Obama's expression, fundamentally transform America. In fact, I think finish it off.
Yeah.
Seems as though the various forces that are beginning to develop here, the 49 United States senators, for example, all of the Republicans in the Senate, 22 Republican attorneys general around the country, state legislatures. I was just in Oklahoma, where they're in the process of passing legislation, you know, saying that the World Health Organization's writ is no good in Oklahoma. This is all developing. The question is there time, in your estimation, to do what I think is required here, which is to postpone action on these two treaties, which haven't even been finished yet? They're still negotiating them and may right up to the moment of the votes. What's that about?
Well, that's just like what our own government has been doing with legislation and omnibus bills, where they release a 1,000-page bill with 4 hours to review it. They don't want people to be able to mount a defense on any particular topic, and that's why they change the language, which is also, as you know, a very common communist or Marxist method, is play with the language, play with the language. So is there time to stop it? Yeah, I think there is time to stop it. Remember, it doesn't have to be the United States that votes no. It takes one country to vote no, and it doesn't go through, one member country. So last year, it was blocked by two African countries, Botswana being one of those. So in my estimation, yes, we need to hammer our own government, but we have to also encourage some of these, you know, more like, you know, different governments that are more in favor of not having any sort of powers given to the WHO, encourage them to just say no, just say no.
Just say no, and more to the point, say not now, which is what we
have, I say not
I think,
ever.
Every reason. Well, I agree with you about that, but at the minimum, we want to make sure that this stuff doesn't get through at the end of this month, and we need everyone to go to centerforsecuritypolicy.org and click on the link there to the Sovereignty Coalition. Join us in opposing this effort to seize and surrender, for that matter, our sovereignty and your medical freedoms. Sovereignticoalition.org is another site. Centerforsecuritypolicy.org is the one I'm hoping you'll take a look at, as well as our donate page. Brian O'Shea, thank you for your leadership on all of this. I hope you keep a surprise.
Thank
you as
well.
Come back to us and keep up the fight, my friend. We'll be right back with
you
right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In Atlanta today, we'll be holding the first of several urgent briefings in key swing states about what should be one of this year's most important voting issues, the strategic arson creating a global conflagration properly dubbed not World War III, but World War Z. After all, it was at a meeting 2 years ago between Chinese dictator Xi Jinping and Russia's Vladimir Putin that they announced a no-limits partnership. Its first manifestation was Putin's Chinese-enabled invasion of Ukraine. Successive meetings in Beijing between Xi and Iranian and Palestinian leaders preceded their invasion of Israel and ensuing regional crises. And Venezuela's tyrant Nicolas Maduro returned from a visit to Xi in China, pledging to attack neighboring Guyana.
The question occurs, will today's Beijing summit with Putin result in Xi's next act of arson? Perhaps against Taiwan or even us? This is Frank Affney.
We're now in the mobile studio. We're coming to you from Atlanta, Georgia, and we're very pleased to catch up with one of our friends who is, well, equally peripatetic, it's fair to say, but also one of our go-to guys on a whole host of issues of importance to the national security. His name is Colonel John Mills. He's a United States Army retired colonel, a full colonel. He has served his country, however, both in the uniform of the Army, notably in the special operations arena, as a psychological warfare expert, among other things. He's also been, as a senior executive, a civilian in the Office of the Secretary of Defense with responsibility for cyber warfare and international affairs. He's been seconded to the National Security Council and also to the Homeland Security Department in the course of his time in government. I'm pleased to say he is a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy and the author of a couple of really important books, The Nation Will Follow and War on the Deep State. John,
and Frank, thank you. Always an honor.
Back. Well, listen, I've got a couple of things I want to talk to you about and not a lot of time to do it. I wanted to start with an essay that you published the other day. I think it was at Gateway Pundit, if I'm not mistaken, in which you really laid bare a tremendously serious national security problem. And that is something that was evident when Robert Malley was a prominent fixture in the administration, working, it seemed, more or less for the mullahs of Iran. He ran into trouble because I think he was passing classified information to them or something. Anyway, he's off the job. But it appears as though some, well, shall we say, mentees of Bob Robert Malley had survived his downfall, if you could call it that. Talk to us about, John, what we know about some of these folks with sympathies for, well, the Iranian regime, in some cases, Sharia supremacism, it seems, more generally.
Well, yeah, thank you, Frank. Hey, we're a diverse country. We have diverse religions, diverse ethnicities. That's a good thing. Nothing wrong with that. But you can't come into and encumber a position with radical ideas where you're playing for non-American teams at the same time you're on the company payroll, on the government payroll. And that's exactly what's going on. Rob Malley, if you look on the State Department website, he actually is still listed. If you look on his X, Twitter, he says he's on leave. He's on leave. It's unclear whether he's on paid leave or unpaid leave, but it appears he's under investigation for essentially, let's just call it what it is, being an Iranian agent. He has two deputies that are submerged somewhere inside the Department of Defense. Come on, this is an absolute fraud. And if the FBI has time to monitor parents at school board meetings, they have time to do this and figure out if we have foreign intelligence penetration into our appointed or careerist civilians or contractors or uniformed military. Well, now we have a gentleman named Maher Bitar, who's the Director of Intelligence and Defense on the National Security Staff, essentially the same group I was associated with at the end of Bush, beginning of Obama. Well, this person has immense influence over whether arms flow to Israel or don't flow to Israel. And these are appropriated funds that have already been approved by Congress, signed off by the president. But yet they're tactically noodling until this morning, because they're doing the calculus because they are definitely, the Biden team's definitely in favor of a two-state solution, and that's Michigan and Wisconsin. That's what their real calculus is. So now they were trying to slow the arms. Now they're stopping because they're realizing it's a liability. And Maher Pintar, I mean, he very likely literally has his fingerprints on the action package that was slowing the arms. This guy also had previously worked for the UN organization, UNRWA, the same group that was complicit and part of the Hamas attack into Israel on October 7th. Totally corrupt group. And he was also a part of a violent group at Georgetown getting his JD. This guy is trouble, and yet he's the decision maker on these very sensitive matters.
Yeah, I think when you say who was associated with the Students for Justice in Palestine, he was actually the president of the Georgetown chapter during his time there. And John, it's hard to overstate the magnitude of this penetration. And again, this is on the basis of not, maybe he had some ties to the Iranians or some, you know, sympathies for them, or it was actually working for them. This guy worked for Hamas, or worked for organizations that work for Hamas, if you wish. And it's just unbelievable that he's the guy who is sitting in a place where he's making decisions about not only what intelligence flows into the White House, but what direction is given to the intelligence community from the White House. And may, as you say, more broadly, have had impact on policy decisions like the arms resupply for Israel. So, John, there's another young woman by the name of Ariane Tabatabai, who I understood was the chief of staff to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict. In your report, you say it's not entirely clear where she is at the moment, but she's still somewhere inside the wire, as best we could tell. What do we know about her, and how much of a problem is it?
Well, same situation. This was one of Mali's lieutenants. I just checked a couple of days ago the ASD SOLIC website in Office of the Secretary of Defense for Policy at the Pentagon. It doesn't list her, so don't know for sure where she's at, if she's on the payroll. It's unclear, but look, they're investigating everybody who was within 100 miles of Washington on January 6th. They need to make sure they apportion resources to the right threat, the right issue. And look, we got folks, if they want to believe these things, yeah, if they want to believe these things, if they want to advocate for Hamas, fine. Get on.
Not fine inside the government, needless to say. John, we have to take a very short break. We'll be right back with Colonel John Mills on the other side of it. Stay tuned, please. John Mills, United States Army retired, one of our go-to guys on, well, basically everything having to do with the national security of the United States. He's got expertise in so many domains, and we are really delighted to have a chance to pick his brains. John, we've been talking about what's going on inside the wire of the Biden administration. That's a problem. But we're going to talk next about what's going on in space and the high frontier and the Chinese. Well, competition for it, I guess, to put it mildly, is hotting up. Talk to us a little bit about a new I believe it's Space Force report on the relative activities and therefore capabilities of the U.S. and China at the moment in space.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. Well, to have a competition, there has to be two in it. I'm not sure we're even out of the locker room on this contest. We've been lapped several times on the track by China. The numbers released by Space Command, I was a little surprised that they would reveal a lot of this information. It shows a stunning discrepancy. We had a report not too long ago. China had a bazillion times more shipyard capacity than we did. I mean, after 200%, what difference does it make? In space, it's essentially the same story. I mean, they're shooting up 200 launches a year. 200 launches a year. We're barely getting a couple of dozen in. They have a series of satellites. The one number that immediately jumped out at me was in 2019, Space Command was tracking 6 to 7 maneuvers a month out of Chinese space activity. That means when a satellite moves to get a better shot, a better angle, you know, because every nanosecond, every nanomillimeter counts in accuracy and position, navigation, and timing. It's very important. 6 to 7. I had to reread this report several times. They say they're getting 11,000 alerts a month. That means China is repositioning what it has up in space, which vastly outnumbers ours, 11,000 times a month. That tells me they want the absolute correct fidelity for position, navigation, and timing, which means accuracy. Several of their satellites are just stunning. The Dylan 1, which it's unclear if that's civil, military, doesn't matter. It can reimage every position on Earth 16 to 17 times a day. It means it can take a new shot almost every hour. That's good enough to shoot a missile in a certain direction because they have high confidence that something is relatively in that area. And then when the missile comes into terminal phase, it'll use its own onboard sensors to acquire and strike. That's pretty impressive.
So this is an anti-satellite weapon, John, I guess you're saying, right?
No. I mean, they could reimage any position on the Earth, 16 to 17. So they're taking a new snapshot almost every hour of every position on Earth. That is stunning. And that's good enough. Hey, we know a carrier is out this way. We have to adjust for, estimated speed. But that's good enough to shoot a missile in that direction that will then pick up the target in the terminal phase with its own onboard radar, IR, whatever. That's stunning. That's stunning.
So it's a targeting asset, not for space, but for what's on the ground or, as you say, at sea.
Yes.
And as part of a means of providing real-time reconnaissance worldwide, this is vastly exceeds, as I understand it, the capabilities of the United States. John, to what end? You mentioned civil military. There are those, and I think the Chinese government itself insists that large parts of its program are for civil purposes. Is that your understanding, or is it pretty clear that this is basically all about the Chinese ability not only to access to and operate from, but also to control what's been called the high frontier?
Well, they massively outnumber us with number of targets in space. Space Command is, there's 1,000 key satellites in space that they are tracking. I would say most of those are probably Chinese. Doesn't matter with the Jilin satellite, whether it's civil or military, doesn't matter. You might as well call it, it's usable. Again, that's good enough, again, for targeting purposes. New snapshot every hour, good enough. They got a number of other, there's a primer, I'm going to put it out on Substack on all the different, but it's just stunning the array of satellites they have up. The TJS series, it's geostationary. There's 9 of those. They cover key areas. They can essentially park over our ballistic missile fields. and they have an IR capability. So the nanosecond a booster goes hot, boom, they pick it up. They know immediately. That's immediately fed into the big AI machine in China, so they can immediately get ready with their ballistic missile interceptors, take response. I mean, there's just it's just stunning all the different satellites they have in space.
And John, in that vein, the means by which they can control space through maneuvering satellites, through laser weapon systems, either in space perhaps or on the ground. You mentioned some curious nuclear capability as well. What do we know about that, sir?
Well, this was the one where a member of Congress had suddenly announced a startling issue of a weapon in space. Now, he was intimating nuclear, he was intimating Russia. And this is where I say, ladies and gentlemen, if Russia's doing it, we can presume China is doing it times 10. So, you know, and this is when this has been one of the problems with space activities. It's been so carefully sapped, special access program, which means you can't even utter the words. It's so tightly controlled, it actually hurts us in the long run. And so this congressman was mentioning this, and now there's this freak out. Does somebody have a nuke in space, which is in direct violation of the space treaty? But again, it's laziness on our part and this presumption that they have more satellites, but we have better satellites. Doesn't matter. We only have a handful of magnificent satellites. Those are going to go down real quick. Much better to have, 100 to 1,000 good enough satellites than a few dozen exquisite satellites.
John, we have to leave it at that. This is a topic to which we'll return with you. Thank you so much for the great work you do with us at the Center for Security Policy. I urge people to take a look at centerforsecuritypolicy.org, as well as John's terrific books, The Nation Will Follow, and also War Against the Deep State. John, God bless you. I hope the rest of you will join us again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.